Hello, and welcome to Preprints in Motion. Join us as we sit down with early career researchers and discuss their latest preprint and find out about their journey through the muddy marshes of academia. But we don't stop there. Every month we'll be bringing you special episodes with open science leaders where we discuss how to fix academia. Easy, right? So hit that subscribe button, leave a rating, or find us on Twitter at MotionPod. But for now, let's get into the show.
It's our Christmas special where we sit down and talk about preprints that were mostly from this past year. It's Christmas! Or if you're not listening to this at Christmas, then it's a very dated show.
Have you got your blanket all around you? You're nice and warm?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I am. I'm tucked up under my blanket. I've got my little radiator going as well. It's very cozy. Cozy. A sort of warm, relaxing, Christmassy atmosphere for the audience. You know, it's, imagine a crackling log fire.
Well, I have my Christmas jumper on, so bad show from you guys.
Okay. Are we actually ready then? Are we? So bets on John having further technical issues.
I'll take that bet.
Wish my computer would just not do things while I'm trying to do other stuff. Like, it just stop doing stuff in the background, computer.
What are you eating, Emma?
Well, I'm currently finished eating bourbon.
Okay. I've got six more. You should have gone with the mince pies. Christmas spirit and all that.
Yeah, we had someone bought a box of the Tesco's little ones for lunch the other day. I mean, I'm about three boxes into the mince pies this year already.
Wow.
Started in like September. I mean, like, boxes of 12 as well, not boxes of six. I mean, they appeared in the shops in somewhere in like September, October.
Yeah, it was early October, because I was really annoyed they were doing the Christmas stuff before they did my birthday stuff. It was very rude of them. I'm clearly not getting the memo this year. Okay, so are we now ready to start, do you think?
I think we probably are.
Should we give it a try? I feel like I've tried three times already, but okay. Let's
give it a whirl, Gail.
Cut that out. Don't leave that in for anyone who's from Liverpool listening.
When you go, yeah. And offend the whole of Merseyside in one go. No, I might leave that in.
I'll never go visit again. I'm sure we've got enough listeners now, we can insult some of them, right?
I can afford to lose a few, so it's natural wastage.
Okay, so good luck cutting this intro together. Today, we are doing a bit of a Christmas special. But it turns out not a lot of people do Christmas preprints. Who'd have thought? You know, somebody out there should be studying Santa, but they're not.
Stay tuned.
Okay. Have you found some? No, don't spoil it. Never mind.
Sort of. Loosely.
So instead of picking Christmas preprints, or maybe picking Christmas preprints, I certainly haven't.
I did try to get them festive, but...
Yeah, you did. Yeah, you did say you had one that was... Okay.
I did find one about someone had done... transcriptome profiling of adipose tissue in reindeers. That was about the closest I got.
Okay,
but I haven't actually picked that one because it was a little bit dry, but yeah, that's the closest I got.
See, I didn't care. I just went with the dry, festive ones.
Like a cheap mince pie.
This is really selling this episode. These mince pies are good ones. Anyway, I was doing something about what we're doing this week.
It's Christmas special.
It's Christmas.
It's like
special.
A normal episode, but with a two-drink minimum. That's just so the audience are aware.
So this week we will be talking about interesting preprints that have been posted this year. I'm hoping you're both stuck to that.
Yes, I think they are both.
Yep.
I, in typical me fashion, have not read either of the papers I've chosen, but I have given them a quick skim, so I know roughly what they're on about. And mine are here to provoke discussion, so I'm very thankful I didn't have to read them.
I've just realised one of mine isn't from this year, but never mind. It's got a festive title, so... 2018.
Oh, it's not even close.
18!
Simpler times, you know, before the thing happened.
Yeah, we're not mentioning that. No mention of the P or the C word today. Either C word.
Well, that's annoying, because one of my preprints is based on that.
Oh, preprint was the P word.
Oh. Oh, I thought pandemic was the thing.
Yeah, that's what I thought the pre-word was. Yeah.
So anyway, we're going to talk about interesting preprints from this year, starting with Emma. What preprint did you choose? I said that with a mouthful of mince pie. None of this is good.
So my preprint, so I was trying to get something that wasn't neuroscience. So I was basically just searching through bioarchive on any topic that wasn't neuroscience to see if anything struck me. And I was quite intrigued by this preprint called Smart Soils to Observe Hidden Rhizospheres Processes. I think that's how it's pronounced. Maybe not. So it's kind of talking about soil as being one of the most complex environments on the planet. and how basically we need it for agricultural production. And actually, production is set to increase by about 50% between 2012 and up to 2050. And we'll need that increase to achieve food security. But actually, I didn't think about this, but soil is apparently non-renewable. So actually, we're using it up and it's not coming back.
So is this as in like the nutrients aren't renewable?
Yeah, I didn't really think about it, to be honest.
Oh yeah, so that's why farmers rotate their crops.
Yeah, I knew that, but like the fact that it's just completely like non-renewable and it's been lost faster than actually it's been generated.
Like as well as like rotating farmers, also there's you'll often see a field of like broad beans where they've basically like been grown and then just left, not harvested, and then it gets ploughed back in. It's because broad beans are really good at fixing nitrogen back into the soil, I think it is. So they're really good. When you've had a really heavy, intense crop on a field and it's like completely depleted of nutrients, they tend to grow a cover crop of broad beans that they don't actually harvest and they just like plough it back in. Yeah, there you go.
Farmer John, ladies and gentlemen.
I know.
Art.
So generally what this paper is looking at is how to measure like soil minerals and how do we know. So basically a lot of the ways that they do it now are quite, well, they basically just dig it up. It kind of damages it a little bit. So they're kind of looking at non-invasive ways. So they've actually made this kind of fluoropolymer that can change color, it's a sensor basically. So it's like soil that can actually grow plants or be mixed in with soil that can grow plants. And they showed like a little lettuce leaf growing out the top in one of the figures, which I thought was very cute. And they basically tested tested to see what the pH. So basically when the pH increases, you get more blue fluorescence. So this can be applied to many different nutrients throughout like different soils. So it basically allow farmers and industrial food production to know what's in the soil and what's going on. So this one's just focused on pH, but they said they can use it for lots of different things. And it could be to quantify biological and chemical changes of the soil environment.
That was going to be my next question. I'm going to do a callback and ask you a microbiome question again.
Oh, really?
Well, so presumably the microbiome within soil, that's very, very diverse. But presumably that changes depending on things like crop being grown. And that, I imagine, would have quite an impact on soil fertility.
Yeah, I guess so. And that's basically the point. They want to kind of measure that, I guess, so they can be like, oh, in this soil, we need to add more nitrogen, like that broad bean thing, and then otherwise not so much. And help them understand the biodiversity. And hopefully, they say, to promote new forms of indoor farming. They basically use this, they use kind of like a waste, like waste plastic to generate called fluoropolymers. And they used waste FEP, or a long chemical I can't pronounce, which is basically produced from industrial tubings and coatings. So I quite like the idea that they're using something that's a waste of another industry to make this compound. And they have like basically a sensor incorporated, so you can put whatever sensor you wanted into it.
Cool soil.
Cool, basically cool soil. And I quite like this paper simply because it was kind of like a new tool to understand a problem. I quite like new tools being made, and I think it's quite applicable to lots of different, well, because it's not, could just, it could work on pH or it can work on like, I don't know, nitrogen levels, and it could be quite variable. So I mean, not the most, I mean, I quite liked it. And it's definitely not neuroscience.
It's definitely not neuroscience. Is your other one neuroscience one?
I have like three to choose from.
Oh, maybe you can do more.
Actually, I have four to choose from.
Oh. I feel this is a very good exercise in our personalities, isn't it? I haven't bothered at all. John's kind of half-arsed it, and you've gone full-blown. You've covered us both.
Well, I panicked. I was like, I didn't know if it was going to be like a journal club. I was like, I need to know more about this. So yeah, if you're into plant sciences, go for have a look at this fancy new soil.
And it'll be in the links, and we can point down to the links, but no one can see us pointing.
Oh yeah, go to the links. I'll put them in the show notes.
Go on then, Farmer John. Now you've read your abstract.
I don't know what you mean. I completely and thoroughly read this paper beforehand. No, so this is quite interesting. This was so obviously, for people who don't know, I'm quite interested in RNA interference. That's what I did my PhD on, so I'm kind of quite interested in double-stranded RNA and all the weird things it does. And this is the thing where basically it turns out that, we'll start from the beginning. So the thing's called stress granules in cells, right? That for people that don't know, obviously collections of sort of sequestered RNA and proteins that basically when the cell is slightly stressed, it kind of like a subset of the messenger RNA gets kind of pegged away so that it doesn't translate into protein, but it's kind of there ready for if the cell then becomes no longer stressed, unstressed. And it turns out that in response to double-stranded RNA being detected in the cell, which is usually obviously from a byproduct of a virus reproducing, there are basically immune receptors that will bind the double-stranded RNA and basically sort of sequester it away into stress granules. So it's not necessarily just messenger RNA in there. There might be, you know, it might kind of put double-stranded RNA away as well.
What are stress granules?
I just explained what a stress granule was. That
wasn't did you?
Yeah, no, I genuinely wasn't listening either. Sorry.
I literally just explained.
I thought that was a really good question.
Well, I'll explain it again, and whichever is the better explanation, I'll keep, and we can lose the other one. So stress granules are collections of basically protein and messenger RNA, where the basically messenger RNA gets kind of a proportion that gets sort of sequestered away when a cell becomes slightly stressed in some way, shape, or form.
Heat shock proteins, then, right? They're a stress protein.
Maybe. I don't know. I think there's all sorts of proteins in there potentially. Like in this one, it's talking about like certain like types of like immune receptor that end up like get trafficked there somehow. I guess the point is here that it's not just messenger RNA when the cell's stressed, but it's also when it's detecting viral double-stranded RNA. It's going, oh, this is not good, and it's also sequestering that away in stress granules.
Sorry to bring it to neuroscience again, but I'm sure these are in ALS. I'm sure there's stress granules in ALS.
And there's another kind of granule, which I can't remember what it's called, that's in muscular dystrophy.
Okay, yeah.
I applied for a postdoc on this at St Andrews, which I didn't get, but
shout out to St Andrews there.
There you go. Had Hannah's as a neighbour though, so you know.
So in your paper, they're detecting viruses.
They are. They're showing that basically that stress granules form in response to double-stranded RNA being detected. I think that's the first time that anyone's shown that. Basically, I think is the gist of it. So it's not just messenger RNA sort of tucked away in the stress granules. It's also, you know, the viral double-stranded RNA also ends up in there, apparently, if I'm interpreting it correctly, as I'm doing now on the hoof.
Based on the abstract.
Is this something that can be applicable to kind of any disease relevance or whatever you're doing? Fly relevant? Mosquito relevant?
It's not related to mine. No. But I mean, as they say, it highlights the role that stress granules play in regulating the delicate balance between the type 1 interferon response and cell death. So when double-stranded RNA kind of stimulates the formation of these kind of stress granules, it basically a load of, so where are things like RIG1, light receptors, protein kinase R, those kind of things get kind of incorporated into the stress granules, basically, which I believe are all part of the, because RIG1 light receptors are part of the interferon 1 pathway.
Can you explain the interferon, not complexly, but what is the interferon?
I can never remember the difference between type 1 and type 2 interferon. Johnny will have to help me out here.
It's an immune response, right?
Yes. Does it the one that upregulates and downregulates certain genes in response to the virus, I think, if I remember rightly. Have a Google somewhere.
Johnny looks quite smug.
Again, I applied for a postdoc on this, and it's gone in one ear and out of the other.
You're not far off.
Could draw the pathway out from memory at one point.
So interferons are big in signaling for the immune system. Different interferons will do your pro or anti-inflammatory responses. Type 1 interferons are released from all cells, I think. And type 2 interferons are released in response to specific cytokines. And so type 2 are restricted to immune cells.
Okay.
As a response to certain cytokines. There you go. So all cells can produce type 1, only immune cells can produce type 2. Although I bet that's not true.
Am I remembering this right? Is the type 1 pathway the thing where it like shuts down translation in neighboring cells as part of the response to like stop a virus in its tracks?
Sorry, can't help.
Have to do some research.
some of that background reading you may have wanted to have done beforehand.
Yes. Again, crying over data. It's got pushed down the list a bit.
So the stress granules have what effect on the interferon pathways? Increasing them. Increase one, decrease the other?
Well, they contain key proteins that are part of the pathway. I think they're sequestered away. So it targets those proteins and also the double-stranded RNA for autophagy, basically.
Okay.
And it's also obviously sequestering away the viral RNA as well at the same time, rather than letting it run loose around the cell, certainly. So
that's cool.
So I guess it's kind of it's compensating the initial response you would have then, right? It's kind of, if it's sequestering them away, it's dampening the response.
Cool. Why did you choose the paper?
Had double-stranded RNA in it. It was recent. And it has stress granules in it. And I did apply for something a long time ago that was on a type of, like a subtype of stress granule. So that was just like, oh, I know this stuff.
You've forgotten everything.
And then, yes, I've forgotten everything. It's just, well, this is the thing. It's the thing. Anyone out there who's applied for lots of PhDs
you forget immediately.
In a row, you immediately forget what the previous thing was on. Like, yeah, I could draw the interferon pathway from memory nearly at one point, and I now.
Like the Krebs cycle. We all remember it, we all forget it. Then we all remember it again, and then we all forget it for life.
I have glycolysis memorized, I think. I think we'll always have glycolysis memorized.
Yeah, you don't need to memorize.
Glucose 6-phosphate, fructose 6-phosphate.
No, we do not. Nobody wants to listen to you recite the glycolysis pathway.
Glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate.
This is getting edited out.
Yeah.
Okay.
So what about you, Johnny? What can you bring to the table? So, I bought my soil.
You bought your soil. John has bought half-baked knowledge.
half-remembered scientific facts.
Yes. I'm about to bring yet more half-baked knowledge. So the first one I'm going to talk about, chosen this one because, to be honest, it was the first one I found that mentioned the thing I want to talk about. And also, it's one of the most, within its category, one of the most downloaded from the year. So assume some people will have read it, apparently. I haven't. But I have read the abstract. So this one is a structural biology community assessment of AlphaFold 2 applications. The reason I wanted to talk about this is because AlphaFold 2, probably like the big pandemic stuff aside, the big thing in science this year, I guess, has been AlphaFold 2. So AlphaFold 2 is this AI-based software tool developed by the guys who create Google, Alphabet. I hate saying that though, because it seems weird if someone's developed. Anyway, Alphabet made AlphaFold 2, and they released this out into the community freely, I think, which is very nice of them, because, you know, they have enough money anyway. And basically what this does is it allows you to, well, it predicts the characteristics of proteins and the folding properties. And this therefore allows us to create sort of more hypothesis-driven research, particularly because a lot of the current mechanisms of looking at sort of protein folding and proteins in 3D are not always that great. So what this paper did was, with a structural biology focus, basically they compared AlphaFold 2 to the current sort of protein databases to see if it was better or not. And basically they found, yes, it was a lot better. So basically they showed that this is better at predicting protein disorders and protein complexes compared to any state-of-the-art tools currently used for those purposes. Don't know what those current tools are. I've never had to do this.
What would you use this for? Like, beyond just looking at protein complexes?
So this could be, maybe you want to look at a certain part of the protein to target. So if you're thinking about enzyme binding, that kind of thing, you could then this allows you to zone in a little bit more on sort of what you would target. It could be used in things like development of therapeutics and those kind of molecules where you need to look
at more like pharma, quite handy for
that. I mean, it's gotten a lot of rounds on Twitter in terms of use for.
I mean, there are some. I mean, I've used one. It didn't. I'm not sure it worked very well, but there are some online tools where you can sort of basically put in a protein sequence and it runs it. So Fire, and I think we're on Fire 2 now, is an online tool that just predicts protein folding based on just the sequence alone, basically. Similar thing to AlphaFold in that respect. But then there's online tools that will then take that structure created by Fire and go and look for where there might be a ligand binding site, for example, and kind of, you know, putative sites where something might bind, and then you can, for finding drug targets.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing that this is really good for is things where we can't do crystallization of proteins, which we can't do for a surprising amount of proteins. So this being a better tool to actually visualize them or predict them in 3D is very helpful for just thinking about how things work as well, right? So last week's episode with Hannes, he was talking about the protein complex he's studying and how things bind together. So this would be quite useful in that, and sort of helping people think about how these things are actually joining up together. Things like how cells bind themselves together, right? That's all done through tethering through proteins, and far too many lab meetings with the Strut Lab for years on end. That's a very complex
process. Are we cutting that bit out?
I don't think they listen, so you can leave it in. And that is, so if we do leave it in, they were studying cell polarity, not cell binding, but sort of how a cell determines which way is one side of a cell and which way is the other side of the cell. But that it's like an incredibly complex pathway of like lots of different things that bind to one another. So it would be really useful in all that kind of stuff, I imagine. But yeah, there you go. AlphaFold, free advert for it.
That sounds really cool.
I have enjoyed some of the kind of AlphaFold bloopers that I've seen online, of like where it just can't quite get a certain protein. It does all sorts of weird things if it doesn't quite know what to do. And of course, you know, some parts of proteins are intrinsically disordered. They're not in any kind of secondary structure. Mm. They're just sort of flopping around deliberately so. And so it doesn't really kind of know what to do with those, I think. But that's okay, because they could be anywhere at any time. That region of the protein could be at any angle, any conformation.
Well, prions, right? Just bits of protein, not necessarily in a nice structure. And they cause all kinds of problems for us. Mainly mad cow disease is the one I guess most people would know.
Creutzfeldt-Jakob, is that's the human equivalent, isn't it?
Yeah.
Have I said that right?
I don't know. I have no idea if you're right or not. It rings some bells, so I think you're right. do a quick Google. No, I think you're right. There you go. So there's the first three. Emma has another three in her back pocket. John's, I think, flicking through his second one right now.
This one's a lot easier to explain, so it's fine. What were you going to say, Emma?
I can read out the titles that I have, and then you can choose which one I talk about next.
Oh, yeah, go on, do that.
It's a pity we're not live, we could do a phoning competition.
So I've got, this is the neuroscience one, early diagnosis of Parkinson's disease, a cross-species biomarker, snow microbiome functional analysis reveals novel microbial metabolism of complex organic compounds. That's the soil one that I've just read out. And circulating mitochondrial DNA is an early indicator of severe illness and mortality from COVID-19.
I mean, the snow one sounds interesting, but then I also quite like the mitochondria. The mitochondria one I'm kind of intrigued by as well.
I would have voted for the mitochondrial one as well.
Oh, good. That was the one I was actually going to talk about.
So there we go.
Let's go mitochondria then. You can check out the other two online, people.
So just generally, I guess, I mean, one of the main reasons I chose this one is I work on mitochondria and I'm quite interested in ER mitochondria contact sites. And also, obviously, we can't get away from COVID-19. And I thought it was quite interesting that mitochondrial DNA could actually be an early indicator of the virus. So it's the idea that viral infections can trigger cellular necrosis, which can inhibit viral replication, so stop it amplifying. And this is through the release of damage-associated molecular patterns, or DAMPs, to trigger innate response. Please correct me if
I'm
wrong.
You're right, you're doing good so far.
Yes.
DAMPs, the other big ones, PAMPs, pathogen-associated molecular patterns.
Ah, okay.
But DAMPs.
And so, apparently, and I did not know this, mitochondrial DNA is a type of mitochondrial damp released by injured or dying cells. And it's actually been shown to be elevated in sepsis, as well as during even sterile injury and trauma. And generally, you'll release inflammatory cytokines and ROS to facilitate neutrophil trafficking.
So how does other cells or whatever in the body detect that the bit of random DNA that's just floated past is mitochondrial DNA rather than just genomic DNA?
I don't know. I don't really study mitochondrial DNA.
So normal DNA will elicit the same kind of response. So I wonder if it is a separate pathway, or if it is just it's detecting exogenous DNA. I don't know. I want to do a quick Google while Emma keeps talking.
Okay. So this study in particular looked at COVID-19 patients with high circulating mitochondrial DNA and found that those with high circulating mitochondrial DNA are higher risk for mortality or require ICU admission or intubation. So this preprint suggests it may be a way to preempt the disease. So mitochondrial DNA could be a measure of inflammation of COVID-19 patients and correlate with emerging markers of COVID-19 sensitivity. And basically, they just show that it can result in the severity of the disease, but it is a marker for it. So it may highlight people who are at higher risk of death, so potentially go on the list for booster shots, potentially. So basically, if they got it out early, they'd be able to be like, you definitely need to go get another vaccination, basically. But it was quite a simple study, I guess, just looking at patients and looking at correlating this mitochondrial DNA with mortality, which is quite sad, and like COVID-19 ICU admissions.
But we do need more people to get those jabs and the boosters.
Yeah. So, because I mean, I guess it could be a different way after you've done age and stuff. It could be, well, I don't know how easy it is actually to detect mitochondrial DNA, but they seem to have done it on a fairly high throughput-ish scale. Mm-hmm. So, because then I guess if you've got people that are over 60 or whatever and have this marker, you could be like, right, you go now to go get it.
Which could also help people who are a bit reluctant to get the jab because they seem to think that they've had it once, so it's going to give them lifelong protection. Or they've had the disease, so it's going to give them lifelong protection, not realizing that's not quite how the immune system always works.
Well, we've always had it with vaccinations, right? With, what was it, tetanus? You have to get tetanus boosters. So it's not, the boosters aren't a new thing. I don't know where people are like, oh, I'm protected forever.
Well, I think it's part of the whole conspiracy of big pharma trying to make money off people. I had this discussion today talking about basically there's the new variant in South Africa.
Yes.
That is supposed to be, it's got quite a lot of mutations to it. It looks like it might be quite dangerous. Certainly looks like it's a really, really transmissible. The flip side, of course, for being positive, is that it's really transmissible, but way less dangerous.
Because that's generally how it works, right? Generally.
Yeah, I mean, you know, evolution, right? Things that survive will generally not kill the host. They don't want to do that.
But they want to replicate, right? So you don't want to kill the thing you're replicating.
So we were talking about it through that angle, but the person I was talking to seems to suggest that this isn't a real thing, it's just something that's being said so that more people get their vaccines and the boosters, so that big pharma make more money from it.
Quick note, I'm pretty sure up until now they have not made any money off their vaccine. They've sold it at cost.
I think most of them have, actually. Yeah. Although, not to give them too much prop, a lot of them have also way hiked the prices to the developing countries where it's really, really needed. They are not giving it for free, or I'm not even sure they're giving it at cost, to be honest.
I don't think they are anymore.
No. So the places where the vaccine is desperately needed are sadly and predictably not going to be getting it for another year or so. Not properly, anyway. So has John had time to scan his next paper, or do you want me to go?
Yes, I have.
Okay, then you take it away, dear.
So this was, I started searching festive things on BioArchive.
And I tried that.
I found things about like migration patterns of reindeer and fir tree forests that weren't very exciting.
Did you find the paper that was like, what's under the Christmas tree?
Oh, I did not.
No.
Hold on. So it sounds like there were actually quite a few Christmassy preprints we could have chosen, and yeah. Neither of you chose them.
I did. I've written up my snow one. I can talk about that afterwards if you want.
Yeah, we can have a bonus one.
I mean, I don't know a lot about it.
I started searching lots of different things on BioArchive, and eventually I was just thought, for a laugh, I'll search Santa, see what comes up. And it threw up this, which has got nothing to do with Christmas at all, but the program they've developed is called Santa Sim. So that was just quite fun, which I imagine a little cartoon Santa running around that you can like lock in the refrigerator or drown in the swimming pool. Santa Sim. There we go. That was the sound of the penny dropping for about a mile.
Lock in a room and take the door out and then set a fire.
Yeah.
Great game still.
Anyway, we'll cut the bit where you sound like a serial killer out, shall we?
I'm sure that was in their marketing for the game at one point.
Yeah. Anyway, so I have combed this paper top to bottom, and I can't find what the acronym Santa Sim actually stands for anywhere in this paper, but I can tell you what it does. So Santa Sim is basically, it's a software package that will basically look at the kind of evolution over time within a population of basically, well, it says, you know, very generally speaking, which gene sequences. It's kind of particularly geared to haploid genomes, so it's very good for RNA viruses. And now this paper came out in 2018, so just before the pandemic. And so little did they know, and I wonder how much use this program has actually had, like during the course of the pandemic. But yes, but basically it's, instead of kind of just modeling the thing as one whole process, it basically separately models kind of, you know, the replication of the genome sequence, possible kind of recombination, point mutations. It can model, you know, insertion deletion type mutations as well. And also, you know, kind of that under various selection pressures as well. And also it'll handle kind of host pathogen type interactions. So you can look at how two sort of sequences that are, you know, kind of doing something to each other. So a particular gene that's maybe involved in viral response in a mammalian host, and then the viral genome itself. And you can look at how they kind of mutate around each other in an arms race, which I think, again, is something new that this software did that no other one has sort of so far been able to do. But yeah, and it just again, because it's, you know, one of the things they kind of labour is the point about RNA viruses, and obviously with COVID, this is, you know, quite interesting. I would be interested actually to go back and have a bit of a dig around and see if this has been used much for kind of, yeah, especially, you know, kind of mutations on the spike protein and, you know, mutations on or natural variation in the ACE2 receptor. You know, that could be a good example of maybe something where this could be used. So yeah, it'd be interesting to do a little, but I've had more time, done a little follow-up and had a look
I'd be surprised, because I just did a quick Google and I also couldn't figure out what the hell Santa stands for. So
no.
if nobody can figure out what it stands for, I can't imagine they're using it.
I mean, I should say it's available on GitHub. It's open source and free to use. So I might go have a little explore of that later.
Do you know how to use GitHub?
Very vaguely. I don't profess to be the world's best bioinformatician or coder by any stretch of the imagination. Far from it, in fact. But I mean, I'd carve my lab book on a stone tablet if I could. But who needs Zoom when you've got carrier pigeons? Yeah. Anyway, but yeah, I will have a little look and see if even a simpleton like me can manage to work out the technology and play around with it a bit. But yeah, I'd be interested to do a kind of a follow up search and see if it's been used for anything much around the pandemic. Because it sounds like it would be primed for it. But it has Santa in the title as well.
It's got nothing to do with Christmas, which has just made me sad. No. To be honest, you're ruining my Christmas.
You could look at the selection pressures that might result in the pigmentation of a reindeer's nose turning towards red or randomly producing a fluorescent protein that allows it to fluoresce in the dark. You know, there's
Had a bacterial infection, that's what it was. It was just massively inflamed.
Rudolph was an alcoholic, that's why his nose is red, yes. It's actually him drinking all that port and brandy and mince pies. Not Santa at all.
Well, now that we've ruined Christmas for everyone.
Santa's real, children, we promise.
Although if you're not listening in December, then it doesn't matter that Santa doesn't stand for Santa. You're good.
I am frustrated that I can't find what it stands for. It doesn't appear to be anywhere in the paper.
It wasn't, and I would have thought a quick Google search would have helped, but it really didn't. Nobody has defined Santa that I was able to find there.
I mean, presumably Sim is simulation, but what the Santa Sim is.
I think they've taken random letters out of what it actually is to make Santa.
It's all capitalized. It's not, there's no lowercase letters in between, which is usually what happens when you the mystery continues. The mystery of Santa continues.
Was it at least released in December?
June. No. Very, very not Christmassy.
Although to be fair, when you're doing like Christmas episodes and crap, you normally record those in the summer. Like all the famous Christmas songs were largely recorded in the summer, so maybe they're actually just getting in there early.
Is this where you're giving away the magic that we're actually recording this in November, this episode?
Yeah, I thought you were going to say summer. No, it is November. Yeah. And I've already been listening to Christmas songs for 26 days now.
There you go. Yeah, I've had a few on.
My Santa hat on my head every day while I'm at work.
People is it?
Giving me very funny looks.
I mean, I'm not surprised.
I haven't worn a Santa hat into work yet. I might start doing that. I was sad because my data was terrible the other day, so I finally got around to sticking googly eyes on my centrifuge. That was how I cheered myself up.
That's cute.
So we've got no decorations for Christmas at work, like at all. It's pathetic, really.
I helped put the decorations up in our office, and I immediately broke the star. And it went, and I had to go out and buy a new one. Christmas was momentarily cancelled in the LSTM office.
I've basically spent the past 2 weeks making and folding paper stars for the office. So the office is littered with paper stars that I've sat and folded myself now, because it's the only thing I'm able to make out of paper that's Christmassy. And then I bought 50 feet of tinsel, which arrived this week. So I'm just going to stick tinsel everywhere in the office. But yeah, and my Christmas hat. I'm the Christmas one in the office. So I've got my Santa hat on. Okay. Paper, well, preprint number 6, isn't it? Yeah, good. I wasn't sure I'd done my counting correct.
Is that you going, or is that you?
No, I was about to start. We were at a pub quiz this week as well, and one of the questions was, what's the total number if you add up the titles of each of Adele's albums? We managed to get...
What happened? Your preprint is on.
We managed to get all of the numbers correct, but we added it up wrong, so we didn't get the point. Anyway,
it like 16,
19? I think it's 95, I think, or 75. I think we might have put 75 and it was 95.
19, 21, 30... 25.
There was a pub quiz the other day where I think the question was what's the distance to the sun in kilometers, and I know it in miles. I know it's 93 million miles, but I have no idea what it is in kilometers. But then someone else knew what the conversion factor was, which I think is 8/5 or something. So then we were sat there literally working like multiplying 93 by 8 and then dividing it by 5 and to get the approximate answer. We were very, very close. We're only a couple of kilometers out.
And this is what happens when the nerds go do the pub quiz.
What are your preferences?
Yeah, well, one of the other questions we got, just because this was, I thought this was a weird one. One of the question was, between 2000 and 2009, what was the biggest selling album?
Adele.
She's up there, I think, now.
I haven't fact checked this.
Oh, I guess 2000, 2009 is probably quite early in her career. Ed Sheeran?
Gaga?
Gaga could be one. No, it, she's what? Later. It, she was it, this one.
It was James Blunt.
Oh, God.
Sorry if James Blunt apparently listens. You're not that bad.
No, yeah, it was. Number 2 was Dido.
Bloody hell, music was bad in the naughty.
And then number 3 was My Guess, which was Back to Black, which was Amy Winehouse. But yeah, James Blunt.
Of course.
There you go. Anyway, sorry, yes, preprints and that kind of stuff.
I tried to bring it back. But
I know,
like,
I ignored you.
About your quiz more.
I thought we should have just done a pub quiz. Forget the preprints.
Yeah, we should have just done a pub quiz.
Right, I'm not going to eat a mince pie as I start to talk. Right, okay. So the second one I chose mainly as a discussion point, because I think I've mentioned it already on the show before, and it's one of those things we might have covered if there was a bit more to the preprint. I don't think there's quite enough to do a whole episode on it. So this is Nepotistic Journals, a survey of biomedical journals. This, weirdly enough, was published this week. I popped up on my Twitter when I was just scrolling around, so there you go. It's been published this week. And basically, what the authors have done here is they have extracted the sort of metadata behind all the biomedical journals that were referencing whatever library that is they've used. And they've done this between 2015 and 2019. And then they've calculated the percentage of papers by the most prolific author. So these are authors who are just publishing the most during that period. And they've used some other indexes as well to kind of rank things a little bit. And what their premise is, basically, is that you can use the percentage of papers by the most prolific author, or PPMP. So they're kind of stealing our little acronym for the podcast a little bit. You can use that as a red flag to identify journals that might be a bit suspect. And it's really interesting because one of the other things that, so I can bring this back to the pandemic things, is you've both mentioned pandemic stuff now. One of the interesting things that's come out certainly the past year or so has been the explosion of paper mills and journals that will basically publish any old crap. And it's not being well challenged by the publication industry at the moment. I'm sure there's a lot of people in the publication industry won't like that statement, but they're not doing a very good job. But it has been flagged quite a lot lately. And so if we have ways of identifying potentially suspect journals, that's always a good thing. And perhaps even better, if we can identify the suspect authors, that's perhaps more important. And again, there's been a lot of high-profile cases lately where people have lost their funding because they have basically just been making it up the entire time. Now, happily, what they find is that the vast majority of the journals they looked at were absolutely fine. But they did find a few where it suggested that this was a way of identifying a problem. And interestingly, particularly in the light of the pandemic, in the discussion, they say, our results reveal a subset of journals where a few authors, often members of the editorial board, were responsible for a disproportionate number of publications, and that these were more likely to be accepted for publication within 3 weeks of submission, which brings us right back quite nicely to the whole hydroxychloroquine issue early in the pandemic, which is a case where editors were leaned on or were authors, and that got published the day it was, the day after it was released.
I didn't realise that it was published in their own journals, I think.
Yeah, so it's often sort of sold as one of those preprints that we need, that make us all be wary of preprints. But it was posted as a preprint, I think, the day before it was published.
As opposed to all those papers that need to make us be wary of papers. Yeah. looking at you, NG Argonaut.
it was posted the day before it was published, and then it might have been a YouTube thing, or maybe just the university website, but basically they published like their version of a preprint before that as well. But yeah, very quick turnaround. It was the I can't remember if it's one of the authors or if it's one of the lab members is the editor of the journal I went to. And when this has been looked into by people, wonderful people like Elizabeth Bick, basically they found a history of that certain person who I won't name because he sues everyone. He has a history of doing this and sort of getting his work accepted into papers where he knows the editors, or he is the editor, or he can lean on the editors, which is a massive problem in publishing anyway. But when I was reading this, when I was reading the abstract of this, this is one of those preprints that has some comments associated with it. So I did read the comments, and it was quite a nice sort of mini review where they brought up some good points. And one of the things they mentioned was that actually a lot of the things that this paper has picked up on are editorials. And so they've mentioned the fact that an editorial might sort of skew the results a little bit, because of course it will, it's by editors and they can post as many as they want. But I think that also brings up another important point, which is the use of editorials as a way of getting around peer review. All those journals that have these sort of streams for publishing that where you don't have your papers peer reviewed, but still published as a paper, which has caused a lot of confusion again during the pandemic, where certain very incorrect papers were published through those streams and then sold as this is something that's been really good. And because people aren't aware of that, they assume it's been peer reviewed and it's all up to scratch, and it hasn't been. So yeah, I thought it was a very interesting paper to generate discussion over some of the practices that people don't seem to think are dodgy, but actually really are quite dodgy in academia.
So what journals did they find that were?
I haven't read it. I don't know. I don't know if they...
Name and shame.
Let's see if we can find them. Journal selection.
We're not naming shaming. We're just repeating what this paper has found.
This is true. This is true. Don't sue us. Thank you.
You can only be sued if you say something that isn't factually correct, right?
It's true.
Okay. So I don't think they do name the journals.
That's probably fair. They probably would get sued if they didn't name them.
So their figures are like the kind of stuff you'd see with RNA-seq data. Like, it's not a volcano. Well, I guess a bit like FACS data, actually. So they've plotted the two different things they're looking at on each axis, and then each dot, I guess, would be a journal. Mm. So you can't pull out the names, but you can see the distribution quite nicely. And then they've got one where they've identified the outliers in it. And it, yeah, but yeah, so I mean, it's not necessarily the best way of identifying these kind of journals, but it is a good way of doing it. But yeah, so I thought that was a good thing for people to think about.
I didn't even know that there was these editorial streams until you literally just said. Mm. Like, I wasn't really aware that you could get it through without peer review. I literally thought
Who is it? It's one of the big clinical journals do it. They were the ones that were in trouble most recently for the paper I was talking about. There's a good one. So the BMJ actually last week, I think, did this in a good way. So there's a Guardian headline last week, Guardian, big newspaper in the UK and worldwide, but mainly in the UK. They had a headline that was, so masks have a 53% efficacy in stopping the virus. And it was kind of annoying because on Twitter, obviously this was shared a lot by those people who are pro-mask, which is not a bad thing, but it was very clear they hadn't actually read the paper, they just read the headline. And I think when you have scientists who are sharing stuff, they should really read the paper, because then it throws their whole authority in doubt if they're just sharing shit that's not entirely correct.
You mean like how we've carefully read all of these preprints that we're now talking about on this episode?
Yeah, but we're not saying this is good quality stuff, you should go make decisions around the pandemic.
Merely drawing attention to them.
Yes.
For people to make their own informed decisions.
Certainly a lot of what I've seen on Twitter were people who were going, well, actually this backs up what I've been saying. So there was a really good one from the Financial Times data analyst guy, John Burnham Murdoch, I think that's his name, who, if you don't follow on Twitter, you really should. He's amazing. He still does a lot of like the really good graphics of how the pandemic's progressing and that kind of stuff. But basically he looked into this one a little bit more behind the headline. And then he did a little series of tweets that sort of called out all these people because they were just sharing the headline. So I went and found the BMJ article. So the article itself is quite flawed. I should say it's published with the peer review, so you can see what other people thought of it. It's a lot of work, but they excluded a lot of... So it's a meta-analysis, and they excluded a lot of the studies looking at masks that were a bit more robust studies.
Why? Did they give reasons for that?
They give a lot of reasons why things were excluded. It's a difficult thing to study because you can't separate out mask wearing as a single variable. So I understand that is difficult, but I'm not convinced they should have done this. But basically, one of the peer reviewers wrote an editorial that was published alongside that article in the issue of the BMJ. And the editorial basically breaks down a lot of the problems with the article, which kind of questions why the journal would publish it, but it was a lot of work and it still is useful. There's an example of an editorial that's actually done quite well, I guess. It's kind of showing the limitations to an article that the article itself wasn't being super forthcoming about. But I think that's a case where they perhaps saw the headlines and tried to head it off, but failed because people just pick up on the headline. The editorial stream is a horrible thing that should not exist, but it does. And it, of course, the people who are editors of journals are largely those who are the big profs in the field who really don't need any help publishing articles. Certainly not pushing them through without any kind of scrutiny. It's used a lot, and it's something people need to think a bit more of.
Yeah.
So should we go back to Emma to do one more of Emma's?
No, it's okay.
No? Are we done?
Was there any like key takeaway fact from the snow one? So like
takeaway.
Snow microbiome, wasn't it? Yeah.
So basically they were saying, I'll just talk about it. So basically lots of things cause stress on microorganisms, temperature, pressure, pH, especially in extreme environments, but they haven't really studied much to do with the cold or the cryosphere, as they call it, which is extreme cold environment that covers a large proportion of the surface of the world and mainly found at the poles, I guess.
It's okay, we're getting rid of that.
Yeah. If organisms are active at below zero temperatures in the snow, then they are likely to involve a range of processes involving organic matter, which could impact atmospheric and biogeo cycles. So they basically obtained 20 snow samples and got genomic and transcriptomic data for each sample and compared early and late spring samples pretty much, and found that early spring samples were more diverse than late spring samples. And this is particularly important. So it's only quite brief. It's kind of important because I guess like we found, you know, like polymerases for PCR, they want to understand novel enzymes that could potentially be hidden in this snow. So they detected many genes in the environmental ice mega genomes related to carbon sources, and suggest that glacial ice microorganisms have the potential to degrade a wide range of substrates. So they're potentially looking for more industrial processes and stuff. So it's not the most like, you know, Christmassy.
That's snowing it though.
Well, snow. And they, yeah.
So is late spring colder then?
I would say late spring's warmer. wouldn't it? Yeah, early spring.
Yeah, that makes sense then, yeah. That fits my thinking, because I was wondering why they would die off when it gets colder.
Yeah, as it warms up. So,
I think they said in early spring there was a higher diversity of core organisms, with only a fraction actually being active. But later on, as it gets warmer, I think they become more active and it becomes more competitive. So it actually becomes less diverse.
Right, okay.
I like that we did the same sound there. Okay, there you go. We got some Christmassy stuff in that then.
Christmassy-ish. Ish.
How do we end this one?
I was going to say, is there any general Christmassy chat we can do? What I don't know, like, how is everyone's science affected by Christmas?
It's going to stop.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be there.
Basically, I am killing a lot of mice at the moment, is how it's going.
Oh.
We're doing like 20 a week. It's horrible.
God.
I mean, they're being used for big experiments. They're not just being killed.
See, we keep all our mosquito lines fully going and stuff over.
Does someone have to come in like they did with flies?
Yeah, a big shout out to all the technicians at LSCM who will be in at various points over the Christmas holidays looking after mosquitoes. We greatly appreciate what you do. I'm just being grateful to people that are helpful.
They offer him his own podcast, and now he's using ours to suck up to get the hosting spot.
Disgraceful.
Yeah, maybe that is a good way to end, though. Maybe we should highlight all the wonderful technicians and people who are not given the credit they often deserve, because they're the ones who really help us and do our stuff, because I don't know what
we're running around like mad professors with, you know, sticky out hair and, you know, it's like tatty lab coat on, panicking and making a mess of things, and they're the ones keeping the ship running.
Speak for yourself, John. I'm very well organized.
I mean, I am too, but I have seen people work in that kind of chaotic manner.
Yeah, I'm really not. That's make it up on a daily basis at the moment. Okay, anything else we can end with?
Merry Christmas to everyone, and hope everyone, because it's going to be released quite close to Christmas, shouldn't we wish everyone Merry Christmas? Well, we'll be leaving work in 2 days, and then it's only a week till Christmas.
Oh, yeah, we will, yeah.
Well, of course, December went fast. Last time I looked, it was late November.
Oh. Yeah, don't not turn up for work in 3 days after listening to this if it's not December.
So, yeah, so there we go. Shall we round us off there then and just say Merry Christmas to all of our listeners. Thank you for supporting us thus far in the year, and we look forward to having you back with us in the new year, I guess.
Yeah, give us ideas on who we can ask or topics that anyone wants to have us get on, because that could be quite helpful.
Yeah, you can get in touch through Twitter, or you can send an email at preprintsinmotion@gmail.com. If you've got any suggestions, do get in touch.
There we go. We can end on that then.
There you go. Well, would you like to say Merry Christmas, Johnny? That you didn't say Merry Christmas.
I didn't feel I needed to. I feel it was said.
Okay. I didn't feel I needed
Scrooge
to.
Over there.
I ain't bringing the Christmas joy in. First,
they'd rather die. They'd better do it in the crystal surplus population. Merry Christmas, everybody.
Yeah, Merry Christmas.
Okay, and that is the show. If you enjoy listening, then hit that subscribe button for more and leave us a review on whatever platform it is you're listening on. You can reach out to us on Twitter at MotionPod or online at preprintsandmotion.com. Didn't enjoy that? Well, we're all scientists here, so send us your review and let us know what works or what you'd like to hear more of, or less of. But until next time, have a good week. John, what have you found?
Oh, are we?
Maybe start first with the one that's from this year, though.
I'll start with the one that's running this year. Okay. This is the non-festive one. Bear in mind, obviously I'll cut this bit out, but bear in mind, I've only glanced at these, so it's going to take me minutes.
No. You'll be leaving my thing in where I talk about not having read them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm prepared to admit that I've not read it, but I'm...
Somebody should. I'm just going to eat a mince pie and shut up.
Okay. Good plan. Behind the scenes, folks.
Well, you'll cut this out, won't you?
Yes, that's all blooper reel.
Oh, yeah. Whilst we're cutting stuff out, we should maybe do a little blooper reel as well at the end of the episode for all the fun
shit. It's like hard to do when you're like... maybe at the end of this one, actually. This one's kind of blooper reel. Just for this one. Yeah.
Anyway, sorry. Go, John, go.
I'm going. Okay. Give me 2 seconds to skim the abstract again, just so I get the idea. It's stress granules and double-stranded RNA and immunity. You're going to love it.
I'm just going to do something else of me eating a mince pie for the listeners instead, then. They'll like that.
I can talk about smart soil if you want.
Emma, go first. Give me time to do what I should have done early today, but I was being sad about my data. Yeah, you can get in touch through Twitter or the email is on the website.
Do you not know our email?
It's
you don't know our email, John, do you?
It's preprintsinmotion @gmail.com.
Yes, it is, but you didn't know.
Is that right? I did.
Yes. That was going so well until you couldn't remember our own email address.
Okay.
You can edit it.
Let me do a run up so that we can then I can be like, okay, so what was it? Or you can send an email at preprintsinmotion@gmail.com. So yeah, if you've got any suggestions, do get in touch.
Well done.
Seems. Yeah.
Where do I find out about the different bioarchive licenses? This CC, BY, CDXY nonsense is driving me nuts.
ASAP Bio have a resource for that.
Ugh, that's your answer for everything.
That's because they have everything you need to know about preprints.
Sure, they probably have the basics, like info on the preprint servers, but what else is there?
There's so much more. Looking to post a preprint, but not sure what different journal policies are? They have a collection to help you out with that. There are meetings around preprints and associated services. If you want to know how preprint adoption has changed over time, there's even a page on that.
And COVID?
They have a big section on preprints and the pandemic, plus some really cool infographics for communicating preprints.
And university policies? Surely they don't have that.
They collect uni policies where possible.
Okay, they do sound pretty impressive, but is it not a bit of an echo chamber?
It can be, but ASAP Bio also engage with people who don't love preprints and have concerns. So we had an excellent discussion on this very topic a couple of months ago.
Oh, is there anything ASAP Bio don't do?
Honestly, no. They're so nice over there. They were so quick to jump in and support this show. It's your one-stop shop for info on preprints and open science initiatives. So head over to asapbio.org to learn more and subscribe to their newsletter for the latest in preprint news. If you want a deeper dive into the world of preprints, then look out for the next recruitment of ASAP Bio Fellows.